Better not push it. My name is Hollis Dodge. I'm an alcoholic. I'm delighted to be here this morning. I've had a great experience. I came in on Friday evening, and I've heard all of the speakers that since that time, and I'm afraid that I missed some very, very good speakers earlier in the week. But I'm just a poor old country preacher and state employee, and I just couldn't get away from work. But those that I have heard have touched my heart very deeply. And times like this touch me very deeply as well. I think that this is definitely part of a spiritual program, and that when we get together at times like this, we are people who are in the grip, if you will, of a spirit that is much greater than we are, that has a plan for us that we do not understand entirely. And I believe that so clearly, particularly at times like this, when so many of us come together in order to share experience, strength, and hope. Every time I speak, I feel like I've gotten 3 months full of AA jammed into one weekend, because there is so much experience, so much strength, and such a great spirit of hope that I leave, and going back to the regular world of work and of my home group meetings and those telephone calls and the morning quiet time, for a little while it seems like I'm still dealing with the echo of a weekend like this. I had two very important things that occurred to me as I was coming to Ocean City this weekend. The one that struck me is as I was driving through Denton, Maryland. And I wondered, why is Denton so in my mind? I don't remember being in Denton, and then I did. It was one of those weekends that had begun inauspiciously enough with another priest and me taking a road trip headed toward Ocean City, I suspect. And we got a ticket in Denton, and the man was very polite about it, the trooper who stopped me. He said, "Sir, you have broken our radar beam." And I offered to go back and put it together for him. He did not stop me for drinking while driving, for two reasons. One, I probably had not had that much. It was reasonably early in the day. But Denton is where things stopped happening for me that day. I have a vague recollection of having dinner much later that night in Little Italy in Baltimore. And then it all just disappears into the haze. You know, that happened to me a lot. The early part of the day was when I knew what was going on. Usually I was shaking it off from the night before, and the idea of a drink had not occurred to me. It was getting over yesterday's drinking that had occurred to me. This entailed a hot shower or a cold shower, lots of hot coffee, and a couple of aspirin before I'd be in shape to go around what I considered earning my daily bread. Which then lasted until around 11 o'clock, when the thought of a drink would occur to me. And the thought of a drink never occurred to me here. It occurred somewhere just down in here. An uneasy twisting of my guts that said, we need some help down here. And this day will be a whole lot easier if you help us out. And the first drink would settle all that. But it always started in process, a series of more drinks and more drinks and more drinks, until it had gotten up around a fifth that day. And that was my general pattern of drinking, my general maintenance drinking, so that I could remain a functional man. I considered myself a functional alcoholic, by the way, which is a drunk with a job. A second thing happened to me while I was coming up here, and I did some graduate level work on AA and the Oxford groups back some years ago, and I had an opportunity to meet a good many people who were still living at that point, who were first generation AAs. And because of that, I've gotten a great respect for those who have gone before us, marked with sobriety, and those who helped to build this program. In a little town of West River, Maryland, There's a little Episcopal church, Christ Church. And in the graveyard of Christ Church, I found it on my way up here. I had to ask a couple of times where it was. And I drove into the parking lot on a rather gray and somewhat rainy Friday afternoon. And this beautiful little clapboard Episcopal church is nestled in among the trees along that quiet two-lane road. And when I went around into the cemetery and I stood just behind the chancel, I stood at the grave of Fitzhugh Mayo, whose story appears in the big book, Our Southern Friend. And I thought to myself then, as I had read this story so many times and found so much about Fitz's story that touched my life, things that we had that were similar, the fact that he was the son of an Episcopal priest. I was not the son of the priest. I was the priest. The other things that he spoke about were the demoralization and the insanity and the encroaching suicidality that plagued his drinking. And how even the style of his writing in his selection, Our Southern Friend, it seemed as though his descriptions were staccato. He would describe something in a very brief sentence, and then suddenly he would move to another scene and it would be described in the same terse fashion. And it didn't seem as though any of them were connected. And my drinking and my living were very much like that. Something in my heart understood what Fitzhugh Mayo went through, and I'm standing at the man's grave. Then I moved over about 50 feet. And under a very simple white stone cross is buried Jimmy Burwell, whose story appears in the fourth edition right next to Fitzhugh Mayo, The Vicious Cycle. It was Jimmy Burwell who helped AA to decide on God as we understood him. Jimmy was a person who had a full religious education. He'd been sent to Episcopal High School. He was a buddy and probably a classmate of Fitzmaio's. And in the time that he was there, he had so much religion that it created a sense of rebellion within him, so that he just completely threw up his hands about the whole notion of God and church, and he went off into his alcoholism. And he got the program, and he got a spiritual program before it was finished. And there he lay. And then I remembered other graves that I stood at. Dr. Bob's grave in Akron. Samuel Moore Shoemaker's grave in Owings Mill, Maryland. All of the sponsors that I have buried in AA. And how often when I drive by, I will stop by to spend a few moments at the resting place of people who have graduated from Alcoholics Anonymous with honors. People who lived a sober life and died in sobriety. Then I think to myself, where will my remains lie? What will it say on the stone? Will anyone come to pass a quiet moment with me? Maybe and maybe not. But I spent a quiet moment at the foot of the grave of two of the earliest members of our fellowship, in an area where I did a lot of drinking. I went to seminary in Baltimore. And by the time I had gotten into seminary, I was in the early stages of alcoholism. It's in my family. And I didn't realize that the sins of the father could visit themselves on the son. In this instance, they certainly did. I did not start out to become an alcoholic, as none of us did. It was something that we just had to acquire a taste for it. And we did. So I am here this morning as an individual who's been in Alcoholics Anonymous for more than half his life. I came into AA in 1977, and I am now 62. And I have been formed by this fellowship. When I speak these days, I don't tell some of the stories of the past, because I've been sober enough long enough so that I'm tired of talking about some of them. But they are there, And while I was alone in my room today, looking out across the sea and reflecting upon being in your company this morning and being in this part of Maryland and remembering all of those dark and gray days that I experienced when I was drinking. And then I remembered all the marvelous, beautiful people that I had met in sobriety. The people that are my examples and are the tall oaks that I shagged up their backs so that I could see a little bit further out to the horizon. The people who led me into the program and seated me and quieted me and calmed me and began to instruct me and began to lead me, not to drive me, into this fellowship. I was taken again so far back into the beginning. And I don't know that I am so interested in being there today. And I hope that a time will come in your lives when the great peccadilloes of your past are not what rivets your attention. But it is that which is yet to come. For the big book tells us that the best is yet to come. Of all the stories in the big book, and I try never to get too far from it, because I have opinions, and many of them aren't worth sharing with you. But that stuff that comes out of our textbook, the book Alcoholics Anonymous, I believe is fair game. And I may move on to my own experience from the experience of the big book, but I hope I don't get too far from the spirit of our literature. The Keys of the Kingdom was written by a woman who was one of the co-founders, or one of the early founders of the Chicago group, Sylvia Cole. And she got sober in 1938 or 1937. And she was a very, very well-known person, or at least a wealthy person. She came from people who were the founders of the Kohl's department stores in the Midwest. I don't know, they're still around, some of them. But she wrote at this time about her experience in recovery when it was published in the second edition of the Big Book in 1955. AA is not a plan for recovery that can be finished and done with. It is a way of life. And the challenge contained in its principles is great enough to keep any human being striving for as long as he lives. We cannot outgrow this plan. As arrested alcoholics, we must have a program for living that allows for limitless expansion. Keeping one foot in front of the other is essential for maintaining our arrestment. Others may idle in a retrogressive groove without too much danger, but retrogression can spell death for us. However, it isn't as rough as it sounds, as we do become grateful for the necessity that makes us toe the line. And we find that we are compensated for a consistent effort by the countless dividends we receive. That has been my story, that has been my experience, and that's what I want to share with you this morning. When I came to AA, I knew about AA. When I was in seminary, we had to do some sort of apostolic good work. It was expected of the clergy to be nice people and to do good work. And I had some choices. I could go into the prison ministry. But at that time, my drinking had already taken me into some fairly dark places, and bars and locks, I figured, were part of my future, so I really didn't want to get too accustomed to them any too soon. So the prison ministry was out. The next was what was called youth work. And to be quite honest with you, I don't like kids. One or two, okay. In platoon and battalion strength, no. So that was out. Then there was alcoholism. Alcoholic training to become a counselor. I thought, this is great. I will help those poor, besotted Christians who come my way. So I took courses at the University of Maryland in Baltimore, and there was a gentleman who was very, very important to that work. His name was Jim O'Donnell, and Jim became one of those teachers in my life. At just the time I was learning to drink my scotch neat. He made a statement while he was sitting with a class of us seminary students, and he made this prophecy, if you will. He said, "What you are learning today in this class may save someone's life, and that life may be yours." And I thought, what an interesting thing to say. I didn't know that it was already too late for me. I didn't realize when I took the first drink at 11 or 12 that I had started something. I had lit the pilot light. I didn't realize that as I was going through high school and we were going out to get a pint of blackberry brandy and drink it behind the bleachers at the football game, that I was already feeding a growing desire and kind of an obsession to drink. I didn't realize as I was pledging a fraternity in my first year of college and getting drunk and falling into the campfire that they had for us pledges and having to be doused by being thrown in the Muskegon River that I was already in the grips of something. I didn't realize that those lost weekends where everyone told me what a good time I'd had were one day going to come back on me like a boomerang and bring with them a sense of demoralization that was almost enough to make me want to die. But at that time that I was taking those classes, I was given a caseload and a briefcase, and in my clerical collar was walking the streets of Baltimore looking for fresh prospects to bring the good news to. I never sobered up a single soul. But I went to a lot of meetings. They were open meetings at that time. And I saw that the people that came to those meetings and took them seriously were people who were getting on with life. Among them, Jim O'Donnell, who has now gone into his great reward. And a good many other men and women I knew at that time who had considerable sobriety. And an idea was formed in my mind at that time is that AA works for those who work AA. And if you don't want what AA has, for God's sakes, don't come here. So I didn't. I did not waste my time in the sip and see method of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because I knew that AA would screw up my drinking if I once made the admission that my drinking was out of control. So I stayed away. I was an associate pastor in a church that had an AA meeting that met right across the parking lot from the parsonage. And on Saturday nights, I always found someplace else to be, usually drinking. And in my drinking career, I also managed to fire up a few other things. And so I found that my experience of other substances was becoming somewhat Catholic. Universal. I came to the conclusion that if it was there, I should try it, and did. And I will tell you now, people, that you can wake up in places you weren't even tired. And you can end up in very close contact with people that you did not know. And you can conclude that while you were not properly introduced, you have become very well acquainted with one another. I made this statement one time at an AA meeting that I led a very exciting life, only about 60% of which I remember. And I once made the observation that in AA, you really, nobody's in the position to throw any stones by the time you get to AA. I mean, I slept with everything except a married woman and a camel until I got up to AA. And I've been in AA for 32 years, and I've narrowed that by one. I one day found myself prostrate before a bishop, laying in the sanctuary of the cathedral church. And next to me was one of the fellows that I'd been drinking with the night before. And he leans over to me and says, "Dodge, how are you feeling?" And I leaned back to him and I said, "Well, at least I'm someplace where I can't fall off of." So I was shot in the back the day I was ordained to the ministry. And then began 3 years of my ministry as a drunk. You know, I guess I don't disparage religion. I certainly don't. I'm still involved with it pretty deeply. And I don't disparage anybody's church. But I do have a lot of respect for the tolerance of the people in the pew. And that made me a very popular person to tell confidential stuff to. In fact, I don't know, and I'm not saying all the way across the board, but there's not a whole lot that I've heard in confidential disclosures from people that I haven't done. And some of the stuff that I haven't, I rather wished I had, because it has given me somewhat of a twist on my church. I am a Christian just by hard wiring. It's no fault of me or Jesus that I am numbered among his followers. But it made me a very tolerant person. I just don't get upset about stuff. In fact, I'm inclined to be a little bit impious at times. And this makes for some interesting sermons. But I've... since I stopped drinking, they've gotten a lot more between the lines. I've had some episodes where a divine worship looked a little bit more like the Barnum and Bailey Circus, which included me striking my head on the front of an altar and bleeding all over in front of everybody. It included me one time after a drunken party just before Christmas stealing someone's chicken out of the creche scene on their front porch and coming home that night in a, I guess it was a blackout because I don't remember, but the next morning at church when I got up and the Christmas trees that were on both sides of the sanctuary, there's a chicken in the top of this one over here. It was a very interesting life, and people had to help me to piece some of it together. But as a result of that, not a whole lot fazes me, not a whole lot bothers me in what people have to say, because we do share a lot of things together. We share the dark and the light together in AA. And I'm afraid that many churches don't feel that way about it. They feel they can only blow happy smoke. But I hear a lot of stuff that, you know, perhaps others wouldn't. I had a fellow came up to me not long ago and was telling me that he was having some exams for what they thought might be prostate cancer. And he was saying, you know, it was really tough, he said, because I had a woman doctor. And she has her finger in places that was very interesting. And she stretched out my stump for about a foot to see what was going on. And I said, well, what was your thought about that? He said, well, I felt a little odd to have a woman doing that. And I said, well, that's probably true, but you're off the hook if you didn't leave her a 20 when you left the examining room. So AA has taught me a whole lot about the fact that this program of recovery is not something we can be finished and done with. It's something that we take with us everywhere in our lives. And it is because we have a past that we have the potential for being of use to other people who have had a past. I preached for many years in a series of churches and finally resigned from the church in which I was the pastor and went to work in a treatment center. And I discovered then that theologically and sort of spiritually that I had come home, because a lot of things I couldn't tell Mr. and Mrs. Christian, I could talk to the drunks. And the drunks could tell me things because of my quasi-ties to organized religion that they would never dare tell their preacher. And after 5 minutes of listening to me, they figured that I was probably a fairly easy touch on a lot of stuff, and they were right. We've been there, we've done that, we don't need to live that way again. I know that that's the case for me. And I found that for me, part of my own spiritual growth included returning to active ministry, which I did several years ago. Different church, but a wonderful ministry, both as an ordained minister and as really a member of AA and as a professional counselor. So I managed to bring a lot of things together in my life at this stage of my life after almost 32 years in the program. And I feel that it has been it's been a coming together, sort of a way in which the program of recovery continues to manifest itself in my life. I find that AA has always been a challenge. The first challenge for me was coming through the door as a member. Having gone to get the counseling work necessary to be a substance abuse counselor while I was qualifying for membership in the fellowship, it was difficult for me to make the decision that I needed to do something about my drinking. You know, it's very easy to talk to other people about their problems, but when the problem is also yours, you do have to submit and swallow and surrender a whole lot of things to make the step to come in here. I don't care whether you're a counselor or anything, whether you're a professional in this area or not, whether you're working in the shipyards, whether you're a farmer, it doesn't matter. It requires a surrender to come to Alcoholics Anonymous, even if the surrender is to the judge who sent you. But it still requires surrender. And that's the first challenge. And it is the first of many, many challenges through our lives that we encounter. And I have met them and seen them, and I am still meeting and seeing challenges. So this is a lifelong program of development, of change, and of improvement. And I am so happy to meet many people along the way. Not long ago, in fact, just a few days ago, a fellow member of Alcoholics Anonymous came to my office, and I'm doing some work with her in another area. And she said, I just feel so crazy today. And I said, well, don't worry about it, Marcia. I mean, we're all outright mental defectives, you know. And what gives us a leg up is that we know it. We know that we're a few clicks off the station. And knowing that gives us an opportunity to have humility enough to click back in and get on the beam. There are other people in high elected office in our country who are miles off the beam. I mean, my God, they're propositioning people in airport bathrooms. They're going to prison for things they've done as trusted officers of our country. We already know that we are robbers and thieves, and so what's to worry about? We had a guy in our area who said this, and now he's dead, so I've used it, and I say it now. I have only sufficient honesty that I no longer steal red-hot stoves. That means that I'm not an honest man particularly, but I'm not a stupid one. I have not found that honesty has been my cardinal virtue, but it has become good business. And I find that when I am as rigorously honest as I'm rigorously able to do anything, that it usually turns out for the better. And I also discovered another thing that came out and never occurred to me while I was drinking, is restraint of tongue and pen pays great dividends. If you keep your mouth shut, a whole lot of things don't happen. But you know what? You've got to have the last word. That's gotten a lot of people lots of jail time. It's got me hit in the head a few times and nearly shot two or three times. I've discovered that perhaps I'm too old to run and I'm too old to fight, so why don't you just shut up? You know, I'm 62 years old, and I was 30 when I got into AA, and lots changed with me. I mean, there's people in this room who knew me when I had hair, knew me when I didn't have this turkey neck, knew me when I could be seen in Bermuda shorts and not be mistaken for a stork. But I've never outgrown AA. It has been an ever-expanding adventure for me. And being in this program has faced me with great opportunities. I love my life as an AA. Let me tell you a little story about the church I'm currently serving. I was working supply. That means substitute preacher. And some guy wants to get off for a little while, so he called old Dodge up and said, would you come on in and cover my pulpit for me for a few weeks? Sure. Well, there was one place that had heard that I was available, and their pastor had a stroke, and he had to go into a nursing facility, and he wasn't going to be coming back. And they were in the process of calling a new minister, and they said, "Would you stand in for a few weeks for this guy?" And I said, "I'd be happy to." It's a very nice little country church. So I went up and I preached for them, and they spent, it took me about an hour and a half to get out of the joint after the service was over, because they were just so friendly. Just very, very embracing, nice people. The next week, I was asked to come back again, and one of the older gentlemen up in years, he said, "Do you know Larry H?" Gave me his last name. I said, "Well, of course I know Larry. He's a great friend of mine." He said, "He said the same about you. He's my son. And Larry is an AA member." So I was hired at that church on the basis of being a drunk's buddy. Well, I knew that if this was already out, and all the other churches that I'd been in since I'd been in AA, I never made any noise about being a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. But I figured if this guy knew it, and this is a small congregation, everybody knew it, I might as well get this over with as fast as possible. So we got into something like new wine and old skins, or something like, or the wedding feast of Cana, where the best wine was served last. And I decided that this is a good time to segue into my own experience. And I said, just as a parenthesis, I'd like to tell you people that some of you know this, but others of you, if I come to your home and I do not take a drink in your presence, it's not because I'm a holy Joe. It's just because I have an allergy to this stuff, and it took me a long time to figure that out. And I had had many, many years of drinking, and I don't drink today. I went off and I got some assistance for that. And so it's not to insult you that I don't drink, but I came to the conclusion after all those years of drinking that I should have had a V8. And as the result of that, I've never been asked to take a drink. And it's great. Everybody knows it's out in the open now. I never mentioned it again, and I don't. They know where I am today, and they know why I'm here. Because I had to hire a shill to come down here this weekend. So I'm a seated pastor in a very small church that is comprised of wonderful, wonderful people that I would not have met if I were not a member of this fellowship. I guarantee you I would not have been invited back if I were still drinking. I keep one foot in front of the other. I do the next best thing I can as a member of AA. When I get up in the morning, it's my sponsors who taught me this. I put my knees on the floor next to my bed, and I say three prayers. I say the third step prayer, the seventh step prayer, and the prayer of St. Francis. Put on my slippers and robe, let the dogs out, start the coffee, and have quiet time before the house blows up. Which it invariably does earlier and earlier with each passing year. I have my quiet time. I don't call it prayer time. It's quiet time, because that's what AA called it. And for many years, although I was an ordained minister, I had just enough of a disconnect from organized religion that I wanted the quiet time rather than prayer and meditation time. I had a great deal of respect for the co-founders of AA and for that early group of Oxford Group individuals who constituted our membership, of whom Jim Burwell was not a part, but Fitzhugh Mayo was a part. And these people of that generation set something in motion that you and I are asked to take care of and to preserve and to pass on. So I don't mind taking some of those original practices into my heart and making them part of my day. Many times as I'm walking down the corridor to meet a client who's coming in to see me, some of them more pleasant than others, I'm asking that the God of my understanding will give them everything they need in the hour we are together. And that I will get my own self will enough out of the way so that the God of my understanding can get through and perhaps can convey something by what I say or do in the time we're together. And I've stayed that way right since. I still go to meetings. I don't get to as many meetings as I used to, and this does bother me a bit. But in the course of staying sober long enough, I finally managed to attract a sane woman. And she is waiting in Stanton, Virginia, with the two children that are the product of this marriage, which is a story in itself. My wife's a psychologist. She married me anyway. We worked together in a treatment center, and I've met some individuals who are graduates of that treatment center, and they know both me and they've met my wife. They knew her too. And this dear thing, who is younger than I am, but not as young as she says she is, got married in 1992, and just as a matter of fact of the wonderful things that happened to us in AA, both of us had decided for reasons, for me, reasons of age, I was 45 when I got married, that it took me this long to start a partnership. I sure wasn't interested in a corporation. So during my lunch hour one day, I went and met with a local friendly urologist who gelded me for the moment, and I came back to the hospital and sat on an ice bag the rest of the afternoon. And I thought, well, that took care of the child problem as far as I was concerned. My wife had her reasons, which were very legitimate reasons, for not wanting to be a mother. Then I realized that this program is also a constantly changing program, because 6 years out in this marriage, I came home from speaking in Winston-Salem and found my wife in bed in tears. She had gone to one of her psychologist friends to try to figure out what was this unrest that she was experiencing, and she informed me that she did, after all, wish to become a mother. And my next question was, and who do you propose to be the father of these offspring? Which ensued a running skirmish for the next few days, which we resolved, and I discovered that what can be done can be undone. So I went back and had their local friendly urologist hook everything back up again, and I thought, you know, this probably won't work, but I'll have a great time teaching her that it doesn't work. The silver bullet found the bullseye. Damn! And a few months later, here came Sarah. And the minute the blood test came back, I was a dad. When it came back positive, I stopped being a single man, an old bachelor, a country minister and a counselor. I became a dad. Nineteen months later, here came John Hollis. Now I'm a dad twice. I was 51 when Sarah was born and 53 when John was born. And I've had a wonderful time being their dad and Wendy's husband. I have a wonderful time being St. Michael's pastor. I have a wonderful time being a member of AA. But there is so much going on now that I have needed to change the way I do business, because I didn't come into AA only to be an AA member. I didn't want to treat my children like they were AA orphans and my wife like an AA widow. So I am home at night. I'm at the dining room table horsewhipping my children into getting their lessons done. I have read to those children every night before they go to bed when I'm in town, since those kids are old enough to hear the words. I have been up to my nose in hundreds of cases of Girl Scout cookies in my living room. And now I have a weeblow in the family, my son. And I will tell you that I still don't like platoons and battalions of kids. In fact, I hate the Cub Scouts. I hated the Cub Scouts the first time I took that kid there when he was six. I mean, snotty little kids with baseball caps indoors, wearing blue shirts and picking their noses while sitting on carpet squares in front of some poor guy who's attempting to lion tame, and we parents are sitting around the back of the room trying to keep our kid at least continent during the hour. And I don't want to get into buried dinners at the Weeblowry. And I don't think it's going to get any better for a while. My daughter just went into the sixth grade. She is now a young adolescent and a young woman coming along. And we end up with all kinds of things happening in our house right now, which I consider to be the rewards of AA, which one of them is, kids, get down here and get your laundry off this bathroom floor. I can't even see the floor for all of your laundry. And Sarah says, none of it's mine, Dan. So I yelled to her brother and said, John, come in here and get your bras off the floor. I guess this is what she meant when she talked about the countless dividends we will receive. What I'm getting at is that AA is a way of life. And it has not been as rough as it sounds. Because I've never had to face any of the challenges in this time of my life any more than a day at a time, and there's always been help. I want to tell you some stories about what sponsorship has meant to me. I don't believe I would be caught sober today without a sponsor. I have had a succession of them. I have buried many sponsors. And sometimes I've gone as much as 100 miles out of my way on an excursion to visit the graves of these good men who sponsored me and who led me. My first sponsor is still living. He moved away to Florida several years ago. He was assigned to another church. But he has now been sober, I believe it's 37 years. And when we came together that first time, and I realized I was in the presence of someone who had been sober 5 years, it seemed to me as though that was as distant as Earth is from the moon. And as we both stayed sober, it seems in ways that that gap is closed and we are still as much brothers today as we were the first day that he told me that I needed to buy a big book and I needed to prepare to take the steps. Jim and I don't see one another and we haven't been in touch for a while, but I know that if Jim were to walk in the room, our conversation would pick up right where it left off, because that's been the way it has with since the beginning. On my way here, my sponsor called me because I'm also his sponsor. And the reason that happened is because the fellow that we both shared, who was both of our sponsor, on his deathbed, the day he died, literally put our hands together and said, I want you to take care of one another. Neither one of you are fit for a good sponsor. He knew us well. And Billy and I have been co-sponsoring one another since. And it was his turn. He called me up while I was driving up here and he says, I want you to call me when you get back Sunday night. We've got some stuff going on in the family that I just need to talk to you about. I need to know, because if I don't talk to you, I'm probably going to kill somebody. And I think I need to talk. And I said, yeah, I'll call you. Yeah. He was the one who taught me how to be a dad. He really did. He not only has a beautiful AA program, because I heard his fifth step when he was very new in sobriety and had another sponsor. And we have been in the meetings together for years. In fact, we even started and sponsored a meeting for several years. It was a men's group. And finally, it just sort of, it folded kind of under its own weight. But we still stay very close. We're still in regular contact. Not as close as I wish, but as close as possible. And he says, you don't want to leave the kids. You've got to be with the kids. You got to be with Wendy. These are the dividends of your sobriety. Take care of them. Watch out for your family. Be a family man. So I'll see Billy later on this evening. And Billy has been, for me, a great example. I had other sponsors who were great examples, who taught me about quiet time and kneeling in prayer. One of my sponsors was an old coal miner from Pennsylvania. And John had gotten through the sixth grade. And I was his pastor, among other things. And I was much more completely educated than John was, but I followed John around like a little beagle pup. He didn't like me when he first met me. He used to call me that priest, and the adjective ended in ing. But I never knew it. I just admired him. And he would go off to Florida in the wintertime, and I would write him a Christmas card, and I'd write him a note about what was happening in the area. And slowly but surely, I wore him down. He figured, God, you know, son of a bitch won't go away. I might as well get to know him. And we became dear friends. And I stood at his grave, And I helped that man graduate from Alcoholics Anonymous summa cum laude. John used to come to my cabin in the woods on Sunday nights. After church, he and I would often go out and we'd attend two or three meetings together. And then we would come back and he would stay at my cabin up in the woods. And one night he said, the first time that we were together, he was in the other bedroom, and I had him say, "Bring me that book." And it was a 24-hour-a-day book. So I brought it in, and there's that old man on his knees next to his bed. You know, I never got on my knees in private. I always got on my knees in public. But this guy was on his knees in private, and he read that. I could see his lips moving with it. He said, "Leave it here. I'll read it again in the morning." And he climbed into bed. And the next morning, I heard his knees hit the floor again. And I thought, you know, if it's good enough for Polacek, it's good enough for Dodge. And that old man died of a very painful cancer. As long as he could get on his knees at morning and night, John got on his knees morning and night. He taught me that you didn't need to have a degree to be an AA. In fact, somebody in AA had once told me that they put degrees on thermometers, and you know where they stick a lot of them. Let's talk for a moment about the retrogressive groove. Retrogressive basically means sitting on your butt and waiting for good things to happen. That's what it is. If you keep doing what you're doing, you're going to get what you got. It says so right here on the schedule for the conference this weekend. Retrogressive means that we've got old habits and ideas in our minds and old attitudes, and those attitudes don't go away. Do you know, occasionally I think I'd like to have a drink? The thought of a drink occurs to me. And I think it would taste good. Somebody the other day mentioned my very favorite scotch. I knew exactly how it tasted. It's wired up here. I remember the sense of warmth that came. And then, thank God, because of AA, I remembered the horror and the demoralization that followed. And I realized again that I have one of two choices, either stay sober or get sober. And folks, staying sober is a whale of a lot easier than getting sober. And like I've heard many people say, this weekend, stick around. Just stick around. A slip is not a requirement. I am a first nighter because I didn't mess with AA until it was time to seek help. But that retrogressive groove is still there. I was at a family's home for dinner several months ago. It was their Jewish Passover, and I've been a guest in their home for 25 years. And they were drinking something called Slivovitz. And it's a very, very expensive brandy, I guess. It's a plum brandy. And it came in the most adorable little square bottle. And it had the most cute little cork on it. And they got these little bitty glasses about that tall, and they pour a little bit in. And you could just see the light refracting from the fumes of this thing. And then they would just take a little sip, and everybody would go, and they'd say, "Dodge, you quit drinking too soon." I said, "No, I didn't." I said, "First of all, that thing's probably got only a pint in it. Two, you're drinking it in little bitty glasses. I would tip the bottle back. I bet that stuff cost a lot of money. That would definitely be pearls before swine with me, because I would drink anything with alcohol in it. And then I'd be out the door to start a run. And at this stage of the game, I don't think I'd run very far before I stopped. Not because I have good sense, but I've known too many people sober a long time who began drinking and were dead within days. I'm just not that tough. So I don't think I can afford that retrogressive groove we're talking about. I need to constantly keep the oar in the water. Jim, my first sponsor, told me very early after I came into AA about the fellow in the canoe who'd come to the park, and he got in the canoe and he pushed off and he was enjoying the sights and the sounds and being in the buoyancy of the water. But what he didn't realize was there was no canoe paddle in that canoe. Which didn't bother him a whole lot, because it was a lot of fun being in the canoe. And he saw things in a way he'd never seen them. He felt things in a way he'd never felt them. Just like us in drinking. But we didn't have the tools either. to guide and direct ourselves where booze was concerned. It just wasn't there. And as the water got faster and rougher, the ride got more bumpy, and for a while it was fun, then for a while it was scary, and finally became terrifying when he heard the falls. And the way Jim explained the AA program, there was a fellow who saw him in trouble and ran downstream and threw him the tools that would help him get out of the rough water. And the man did, by dint of horror, managed to get himself back up into calm water again. But he could never let up on the oar work, the paddle work. He had to constantly keep that oar in the water to keep the current, which is very, very subtle, from taking him back down to the falls. That's what Jim told me about alcoholism. That's what I remember about the retrogressive groove. You know, there's lots of stuff that you and I have done in our lives, and we look back on it. Whatever they say about we do not wish to forget the past or shut the door on it, that's not true for me. There are a few episodes in my life that I will never get over. Because they are, it's not because I was raised different, it's because as I look back on them, they were so destructive, they were so self-centered, that knowing that I am capable of returning to that still scares me to this day. And maybe those things are like what Paul talked about as a thorn in the flesh. And what he heard in return was, my grace is sufficient for you. And maybe that's what the AA program is telling me, is that don't forget your past. You won't be allowed to shut the door on every chapter. But you can live a day at a time free of the obsession to drink if you do certain things. But as I look back on it, there's a lot of wreckage. And you have a lot of wreckage. And say what we will in the quiet of the night when we don't feel well and we cannot sleep, occasionally one of those old demons will just sort of rise up a bit and percolate to the surface of our conscience. And we will be literally prostrated by our memories. But Sylvia Cole says that it isn't as bad as it seems. For we are grateful for the necessity that keeps us towing the line, and that the very horrible things that happened to you and me in some ways set the stage for the rest of our lives. I'll close with a story that I heard many years ago from a fellow named Ray Bennett. And I don't know if Ray's still telling the story, and I give him credit when I'm around, but Ray told this story and it left a terrific impression on me. About an old gentleman in Winchester back during the Depression. And there was nobody who had jobs during the Depression. This fellow was the son of an orchardman. And he had never shown any great academic prowess. So Dad kept him home on the farm. And it was an orchard. And the young man knew nothing but apples. He'd never gone to school very much. The Depression, finally, they foreclosed on the farm. And the old man died. And so this half-witted fellow walked into Winchester looking for work. He says, all I know is apples. God, help me to find a job where I can be around apples, for that's all I know. And as he was walking down the street in Winchester, he asked the fellow, do you know of anybody who's looking for helpers? And the guy said, yeah, there's a place around the corner, about two houses up on the left. Go up there. Well, he went up and knocked on the door, and he was ushered into the parlor of Winchester's most prestigious bordello. And the lady thought he was one of the local Johns, and she asked him what he was there for, and he said, ma'am, I heard you're looking for help. And she said, yes, we are. We're looking for an accountant, because I'm not able to do this, and this is really quite a business here, and I need somebody who can be both discreet and very, very skilled with the books. He said, ma'am, I never went to school much. All I know is apples. I can't read, and I can only count to 21. And he said to her, ma'am, I'm so hungry that my stomach thinks my throat's been cut. Do you have anything for a hungry man? So she sent him out to the kitchen where there was a peck of apples on the counter. Well, he knew apples. So he spread them all out and he polished them up on a dish towel, and he picked out the 10 best apples and put them in a paper bag and let himself out the back door. And he's walking up the street eating an apple when one of the other stumble bums in town came up to him and said, that's a beautiful apple. I'll give you a penny for it. So he sold him a penny, apple. Sold another one. Ate a few more. Sold a few more. And an idea was born at that point in his life. The next morning, with the money that he had in his pocket, he went down to the produce market and he spent several hours looking at all the apples, polishing them up on his shirt, putting them in the same bag, and he sold those. And he was able to eat, and he was able to make a little money, and slowly but surely, his business began to grow. He got someone to hand letter him a sign which says, "I know apples." And it was on a little box with a cord around his neck, and he sold apples out of that until he could afford a little push car. Then he got an old Model A Ford. And 25 years later, this guy is a multimillionaire. He's got apple trucks running his product all over the East Coast. In fact, he bought the old family orchards back and several thousand more acres. And on every one of his signs, it says, "I know apples." And his lawyer comes into him and says, "You're being eaten up by taxes. We've got to open up some sort of a foundation so that you can funnel off this money." He says, "Write it up. Bring it in." So the next day, the lawyer comes in with a stack of papers, and he slides them across this man's beautiful mahogany desk, and he says, "Why don't you read through those and sign them?" And the guy said, "Don't you know, I can't read and I can't write." And the lawyer said, "My God, for all the wonderful things that have happened to you in your life, you can't read or write? What could you have been if you could have read and written?" And he said, "I'd have been a bookkeeper in a whorehouse." It's not much different for you and me. Not much different at all. We are what we are by the things that have happened. We are who we will become by the grace of a loving God and higher power. And I want to thank you for this weekend and your attention. Thank you very much.